You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The Great Depression was among America's darkest hours. The 1930s were a time of desperate economic circumstances for people from all walks of life. In Milwaukee, more than 40% of wage earners lost their jobs between 1929 and 1933. But it was also during this time that the federal government found some remarkable ways to put people to work, and one of them right here in southeastern Wisconsin. The Milwaukee Handicraft Project used the vision of women artists and employed thousands of people in making wooden and cloth articles. That project is seeing new life in an exhibit that opened in April at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Graham Reed is the director of collections there, and Dr. Charles Waisbrunn is the collector of many of the objects in the exhibit. We first spoke in early April, and Reed told me then about the Depression-era project itself.
The concept that you would have a relief program that employed people, predominantly women, who were essentially deemed almost unemployable, to bring them into a program that made such remarkable things based on aesthetics, design, and education, and that these products would be dispersed not just within the city or within the state, but actually nationally to taxpayer-supported institutions, schools, libraries, hospitals, orphanages, that really fulfilled a need, not just for the people who received these products, but they were absolutely essential for the people who made the products as well, because these products really gave these people a sense of purpose, a sense of pride. It gave them ownership of something. It also gave them a paycheck.
Well, it sounds like it follows the WPA model where you're bringing people in, you are creating things for basically an unemployed workforce. But as you say, what makes this unique is that this was specifically aimed toward women and it was integrated. And it was integrated in 1935 in Milwaukee when that just wasn't done.
Yeah, I mean, they went to Elsa Obricht, who was really the champion and leader of the whole project. And they actually asked her, would you take African-American black workers? And she said, because a lot of the other programs wouldn't. And she said, yes. 250 showed up on the first day in November 1935. By the end of the week, there was about 900 people coming to this program because they had heard that there were jobs available for them.
Well, Charles, how did you first learn about this and then become a collector of these objects?
Basically, I was interested in the WPA and the Federal Art Project as a whole because I thought they really developed wonderful works of art. And again, most people are familiar with the big murals that they did in post offices and a lot of the paintings and the prints. And I think really what drew me to the WPA works is I felt it was really true American art. So here were artists who weren't really constrained by what would sell. They could really do what they wanted to do, and they were paid a weekly stipend for creating works of art. So I don't think they were really under the constraints that a lot of other artists had to do in that they were trying to sell works. Again, the works they produced really showed the American scene and really showed what they were feeling during these real hard times. And I was sort of drawn to that look. And when I moved from New York to Milwaukee, I learned about the Milwaukee Handicraft Program. And again, I think what's so amazing about the Milwaukee Handicraft Program is when they first started, you know, the initial idea was for them to cut out wallpaper objects and make scrapbooks for inmates in the county institutions. And Elsa Albright said, no, that would not be of interest to me at all. And so instead of just doing busy work, they really created wonderful works of art. That's what I liked about it.
Let's talk about Elsa. Who was she and why was she the person that the WPA went to say, can you start this project?
They went to the Milwaukee Teachers College and had this idea of cutting out the wallpaper. And Elsa Albright was the fine arts director at what was really become UWM now. And so they went to her because she was going to develop this handicraft project. And they dealt with handicrafts because they felt this is what unemployed women could do. You know, they could do, they could do scrapbooks.
And they could stitch something.
Were just going to cut out stuff. And she said, no, that's not what she was interested in all. And she declined. And then when they came back to her, she said, okay, well, I want to hire people who I've taught. And they could be the program directors and they could organize the women workers to do, you know, fine works of art.
When Elsa kind of decided to take this project on, she looked around for qualified, experienced designers and craftsmen, but most of them had jobs or were already on other programs. And so she actually ended up going to her students, many of whom who could not find jobs during the middle of the Depression, and they became the designer foremen. So this was not Elsa and a whole group of, you know, highly qualified instructors and craftsmen who actually did this program. These were basically young people in their early mid-20s who were designing these objects, making the prototypes, and then basically teaching the workforce how to make them.
So those 900 people showed up at the end of like the second day that this was announced. Did they come with any skills at all? I mean, other than, say, basic sewing skills to be able to mend clothing?
They really didn't even have basic sewing skills. Okay. They were considered really unskilled.
Some of these women didn't know how to – what end of a pair of scissors to hold. They were actually a very nervous and scared group of women who showed up because they didn't really know. They were just sent to the address and they showed up and they were kind of – we don't know what we're going to do. We don't know what we're, you know, we haven't had a job for years, may not had a job ever. And so there was a great deal of apprehension on that first couple of days.
So what were the first things that Elsa had them do then?
See, it was interesting. For instance, the way it really set up is, for instance, Elsa, for the doll program, she took a prize student, Mary Jane Kellogg, who was still in school, and made her head of the doll making program. So her job was really to set up these women to you know, help create the dolls. But it wasn't just throwing them in. She went and got a very, very known professional doll maker to sort of help design the doll. And so they'd had the design, and then they were they taught the students how to either, you know, cut fabric for the clothing or to press fabric into to make the head the mold for the dolls. They taught them everything. They did other projects. You know, they did dolls, they did toys, they did costumes, they did bookbinding, they did textile printing, all having as a head of one of the departments, one of the prize students or recently graduated students sort of helped design and helped train these workers. All these departments had a real trained, sophisticated, educated person sort of leading
the
trips.
How long did it take to get this up and running as a business?
I mean, it started in November 35, and really by 1936 they were up and running. And you know, the textile printing was one of the first things, but then they moved into theater costumes, furniture. They did a lot of – in fact, they actually almost got to the point where they were doing an interior design service where they would do desks and tables and chairs and wall hangings and rugs. So for schools, universities, hospitals, if they wanted to refurbish their offices and common areas, they would – and it was a great deal because basically the institution only paid the cost of materials because the labor costs were basically paid through the federal
government. Okay, so the WPA paid
basically,
that.
Yeah,
okay.
The WPA paid that, but basically the purchasing institution paid the cost of materials, which in most cases was literally cents.
Less yeah, than
there's only a few furniture aside – but most of the other things, I mean, the most expensive doll was, what, $2.25?
$2.25,
yeah.
Now, interesting enough, though, these were really not available to the general public.
Okay.
But they had to be tax-supported institutions. So let's say a nursery school teacher would say, hey, it would be nice to have something in my classroom. And so the school would go pay the $2.25, which is also an interesting point is who owns all this stuff? And that's become a much, much bigger issue, obviously, with the fine arts, with the prints and the oil paintings and things like that. And that – the government still says they own it and it's – you know, they don't really want that bought and sold on the private market. The handicraft items, the federal government doesn't really go after and doesn't really claim ownership, although in reality – it probably is still owned by the individual schools and institutions.
I was going to say technically whoever purchased it, you know, if they're still in existence, you know.
And many of them are not. The biggest take-home message to the whole Milwaukee Handicraft Project is the quality of work. And if you come to see the exhibit, you're going to see just wonderful wall hangings, wonderful block prints, wonderful dolls. You know, just the work is just fantastic. I know in the doll program, Helen Clark was in charge of the doll program, and she really insisted on quality work. So the stitching of the clothing had to be perfect. Otherwise, it wasn't accepted. Everything had to be perfect. They ran a very tight ship.
And I was looking at some of those. Graham pulled out a couple for me when I was up last week. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the stitching and I was looking at the buttonholes that were made and everything. And it's beautiful, beautiful
yes.
work.
Well, it's really interesting. I was reading an interview, a transcription of an interview with Elsa Obrecht, and apparently some of the ladies who worked on the program who were making the doll clothes actually basically took the patterns, took them home, and then upscaled them to make clothes for their own children. So it's kind of a nice reversal. It's not like we're taking adult clothes and shrinking them down to doll size. They were taking doll size clothes and enlarging them to fit their children
because the
designs were so good. Mm-hmm. And they knew how to make them. They knew how these things went together because they'd basically made miniature versions of them.
Are there still any women living in Milwaukee that we know of that were part of this program?
About 10 years ago, I think at the public library, they had some of the people who designed the toys were alive and talked about it. I don't know if anyone is still alive.
I doubt it.
They would be pretty old at
this point.
One
of the things that just as a consequence of the people who got employed by the Handicraft Project, it tended to skew fairly old right from the get-go. So these were women in their 40s, 50s, even 60s or older.
But there must be relatives and people who are descended from some of these women.
Yes. I knew a lady for many years, Betty Sullivan, whose mom worked on the program. And they had pictures of her playing with the dolls. And she was very active in collecting the WPA dolls and the programs themselves. And I think she donated all her stuff to the museum here in Milwaukee. And so she had a connection because her mom was mm-hmm. very active in it. And I know that Henry Sinodal was an artist a lot with the program. And someone I know from New York has been in contact with his son and talked about the program. So he lives here in Milwaukee as well.
So obviously this program was well known at the time in Milwaukee.
It was known nationally. It was known as the project that made Milwaukee famous. It was a kind of play on the whole the mm-hmm. beer thing. But it was known as the project that made Milwaukee famous.
And so did other cities take it as a model to use for?
I think they tried, but nobody came close to replicating
it. No one did come close. I mean, Michigan State Teachers College had a handicraft program. Indiana had a handicraft program. Missouri had a handicraft program. Ohio had handicraft programs. But none of them really had the sophistication that Milwaukee did. There was more just – as far as the doll programs, they made foreign dolls to sort of show the dresses of foreign countries. Nothing with the originality and the wonderful workmanship that Milwaukee had.
I don't think you can ever underestimate the importance of Elsa Obrecht. I mean, she really just drove this thing, her passion, her commitment to it. I mean, I don't think this thing would have been anywhere near as successful without Elsa. I mean, she fought in 1942-43 as war production was taking over and the program was essentially becoming redundant. I mean, she fought to keep this thing going. And they just kind of said, look, we can't keep this thing going. We've got war production and, this is not it. This program is really not needed anymore.
So, Charles, I'm going to put you on the spot for a moment. I know you collect a lot of this, and a lot of what is on view here is from your collection. Do you have a favorite?
Do I have a favorite? I like the wall hangings the best. I just think the workmanship is wonderful. And I kid aside, I have a large doll collection, and my children are absolutely aghast that I have dolls. And they don't understand it. I think the dolls are wonderful, though. I always have to – after I say that, I have to say, I coach basketball and I play tennis and I'm –
But I have dolls.
But I have dolls. So
and what's neat is in the exhibition, not only are we going to have quite a number of the dolls, but we actually have one of the original molds that the head was made from and the original paper pattern that the doll, the 22-inch doll, which was kind of the benchmark, it was kind of the ultimate doll that was made by the program. We have a set of the paper patterns and we have a head mold and then we'll have kind of quote-unquote a naked doll. So if there's any doll aficionados who are listening, you will really be able to see how these things were kind of made.
And the design that went into
them. And the design
them.
Of how they were constructed,
The toys were wonderful too. So they had boy toys as well as girl toys. The toys are fantastic.
I saw some of the little trains and some of the trucks.
The toys
and
are fantastic. And again, they have a wonderful look and the toys are absolutely fantastic as well.
Well, Charles and Graham, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about the exhibition and for your enthusiasm for bringing it to light. Because like I said, this is something I knew nothing about, and I am thrilled to know what happened right here.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Bonnie.
The exhibit Handmade for Hard Times, the Milwaukee Handicraft Project, runs at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend through June 15th. Graham Reed is the director of collections at the museum. Charles Waisbrunn is a collector of Milwaukee Handicraft Project objects, and he loaned many of them to the museum for the exhibit. We first spoke with them in early April. We'll take one last break and then meet up-and-coming Milwaukee photographer Valen Gillette. Lake Effect returns with that conversation right after this on WUWM.